Thank you. Thank you, and I guess everybody thanked the organizers, so I would like to put my name on that list also. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you. What I'm going to talk about is joint work with Heiko von der Mosel and with Marta Szumańska. And I thought for some time yesterday what would be the best way to start. And I'm going to start with a short movie. And the movie was made by Tobias Hermes, PhD student of Heiko, who graduated on the first day of this four-week program. And I decided to use this movie because many of you have been showing excellent pictures of knots and then telling us that that doing some Reidemeister moves, you can recognize that this knot, which was originally pretty complicated, is in fact just a trefoil or some other knot. Igor had some pictures like that. And if I remember, Randy had some pictures like that during his talk also. And I recognize that many of the pictures that were shown come, in fact, not from a schematic representation of Reidemeister moves, but from a program that is well known to probably most of you, Rob Sharain's knot plot. And knot plot can show you how a closed loop would move under some gradient flow of some energy, and I'm going to show a movie of that kind, a movie that comes from the numerical work in Tobias Hermes' PhD. And it shows you a knot moving. Oh, wait a second. I want to make it full screen. So now you see, now you just see a knot. It's like you were flying around and you would see it from several directions. It's a closed loop. The thickness is used just to make it more plastic. And there are 750 time steps of a numerical algorithm. It is standing still now. Now it moves. Now it moves. And now everybody sees that it is an unknot. Still, there are things that are going to happen here. Somehow, it's a sort of a numerical Fata Morgana. So it straightens itself and eventually it becomes very, very close, still closer to a perfect circle. And I'm... Yeah, so that's a movie that Tobias made and he misunderstood Rob's intention.
Well, that was... So you called it a... My first name or last name. I said,
No. It's just called an unknot thick and unknot thin.
Half of a knot that someone who's in the audience suggested as.
Yeah. Rob suggested it to Bias.
It was in the paper of one of the people in the audience back there, mm-hmm. Along, and Mike Friedman and Jim Kipper, of a knot that you need to increase the crossing number.
So that's the same thing, but just the central loop is drawn thicker.
Double on that long end there was the.
And now the gradient flow of an energy starts, and you see how the center line moves, the thickness is added afterwards to make it nicer. And there is a parameter P behind that governing something. This parameter P here on this movie is close to 50.
I'm sorry, Rob, you're talking in code. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I will show the picture.
Well, let's have Pavel.
I will, Rob's.
Let Pavel tell us what he thinks he's showing us.
Rob wanted to say probably that what he intended to give to Bias as the data were two pieces like that. Imagine a second guy like that,
yeah.
Cut this here,
okay.
Cut this in the second one and join them.
Okay.
It will still be an unknot. And Rob wanted to see a picture of that unknot moving under this gradient flow, and Tobias misunderstood him because Rob gave him just that half created from the rope, and spoke in his beautifully accented American English, and Tobias is German, and Tobias thought that this is just his initial data, and Rob told him to take two pieces like that and join them, and this is something Tobias didn't understand.
So what you're saying is when that loop gets pulled in, to undo the knot, that first loop, if another knot on the other side, so, like if we have more crossing.
Enough movies.
The less crossing.
Can you please switch off the... So I'm going to explain you what is the energy behind that and tell you what we know and what we don't know, because those features were just a numerical simulation of solutions of the gradient flow of a knot energy, and we have absolutely no proof that those solutions exist. So that's why I said it was a numerical Fata Morgana, because there is an equation, you can discretize it, you can write down an algorithm, you can produce movies even, that's what Tobias did, but we have no proof that solutions of this equation exist. So, what I will talk about? I will talk about closed curves from the unit interval into R3. So you can imagine that it is closed. It is parameterized by arc lengths. And otherwise, I just require it to have unit. So it's a closed loop of unit length, no more regularity. So if you imagine something like that, that's fine. If you imagine something like that of length one with several points where you have a self-intersection, that's fine. If you imagine a guy that has some corners and self-intersections and length one, that's also fine. So these are my objects. And the energy, so one of several energies we consider, is defined as follows. You take, so I'm going to draw the picture in the opposite direction. You take your curve, this is not my curve. You take your curve. You take a triple of points on it. Maybe that triple, X, Y, and Z. And then, generically, that triple will define you a circle, and you call the radius of this circle R of X, Y, Z. And 1 over R of X, Y, Z is called by some mathematicians C of X, Y, Z, and this is the Menger curvature. That's just the name of the triple XYZ. So what do we do with that? And what's the energy behind the picture that I showed you? So the energy, M with the parameter P over curve gamma, is a triple integral of 1 over R to the power P of XYZ over all possible triples XYZ on your curve gamma, and you integrate, I will maybe write it here, with respect to DH1 of X. So length, you integrate it with respect to the natural measure. DH1 of X, DH1 of Y, DH1 of Z. Yeah? Like that. So you could take any P that you like here, but I'm going to consider this for p bigger than 3, and let me tell you why. So p equal to 3 here is the scale invariant case. If you blow up your curve 10 times, then the length will grow 10 times, and this will grow 10 times, and this will grow 10 times, so this measure in the product will grow 1,000 times, but all the radii will grow 10 times also, so the cubes will grow 1,000 times, and there will be a cancellation, and the energy will remain the same.
Let's be clear, that the h is the integral along the path.
This is the integral along the path with respect to arc length. The H1 is for Hausdorff measure in one dimension.
That you could write DS1, DS2, DS3,
and then yeah.
S, Y, S.
I could write DS1, DS2, DS3, RP of gamma over S1, gamma over S3, S2, gamma over S3. That would be the same. Thanks, Randy. So
the first observation is that in the scale invariant dimension, for the scale invariant value of p, corners have infinite energy. Why is that so? Because if you have a corner, a polygonal corner, maybe two edges like that, and then you look at one half of this segment and one half of that segment, then the energy input from the red part of the curve, because of scale invariance, is the same as the energy input from the 1/4 here. And this is again the same as the energy of the orange piece here, and so on and so on, and you can do it infinitely many times. So if you have a corner like that, and this has non-zero energy, so it will blow up. And this, the same phenomenon will happen for any p bigger than 3. And this won't happen for p below 3. So this is a threshold case, and above this threshold case, it took us a long time before we were able to do something. But above this threshold case, you can really prove some results. And so let me try to explain. To explain, maybe start with the following one. So suppose that p is bigger than 3, and gamma from 0, 1 to R3 is any closed and rectifiable curve. So something like that. If this Menger curvature of gamma is less than some finite number, well, less than infinity, let me write it like that, then first thing which happens is that the image of the unit interval is a circle or a segment. When I speak a circle or a segment, I mean it topologically. So it is homeomorphic to a circle or a segment. So nothing like that can happen. This is excluded. If the energy is finite, this is excluded. I cannot tell you that if the energy is finite, then your parametrization is really one-to-one. Because what could happen would be the following. You could, go around the circle twice, or maybe even go around the circle twice and go back and forth a little bit. You could move in many directions, but this energy wouldn't see that. The radius would be just constant and the integral would be finite. But once you reparametrize it,
So after reparametrizing, you also cannot have corners. This is also excluded, as I. And I can tell you more. When you look at the arc length parametrization, the derivative of this arc length parametrization is its oscillation is bounded by the distance of parameters to the power 1 minus 3 over p. And there is a factor here, and this factor is just the local energy of that little arc. So you maybe have a little arc of your curve. This is S, this is T, this is gamma prime of S, this is gamma prime of T, unit vectors in the arc length parametrization, and we can tell you that they differ by at most a constant, which depends on P. This constant blows up to infinity as we try to approach this scale invariant case. It is stable. It is stable when p approaches infinity. And the thing here, this is the distance to some positive power. So it tells you that it is small. And there is another factor, which only comes from the energy of that little arc. So if the points are close together and this integral is finite, then this must be small if the points are close together. And this, when I want to be honest, I should tell you that this happens at small scales. So for S minus T smaller than roughly the energy of the whole curve, let me denote it by e to the power minus 1 over p minus 3. So this is the capital E. So that's the first result that we have.
So the no crossing is the same argument you just gave, right? Because that picture there is a generic crossing.
Yeah, that's roughly that argument. That's maybe it's important to see what this thing does penalize, intuitively at least. So it penalizes two things. This is a corner like that. If you would like maybe to draw a crossing like that, almost tangential, then it would be even more penalized because there would be lots and lots of very small circles here. So an angle is penalized. A crossing like that is penalized. A multiple crossing is also penalized. But what is also penalized is something like that. You have two long and very smooth strands of the same curve. And when you use classical notions of differential geometry, the curvature here is very small. The curvature or the integral of curvature doesn't penalize anything like that because the curvature here doesn't know that there is another strand there. But if you start drawing circles that contain at least three points of your curve, then you have plenty of small circles here. And such behavior, such coming close together of two strands is penalized too.
And then P being infinite is the maximizing the global radius.
So as P goes to infinity, then NP of gamma to the power goes to thickness, yeah, to the one over thickness, because this is one over the to one over thickness. So
What is thickness?
Thickness here.
It's the minimum of that.
Thickness here is the maximum thickness of a tube that you can put around, of a round tube that you can put around your curve, so that the vertical sections of the tube are non-intersecting disks. Okay. So it's
the minimum of that R over the whole over all triples.
Yeah. That's the just the minimum of the whole R. So you could, since we mentioned thickness, it's maybe a good point to mention a few other energies. So other energies would be the following. So let me first define rho g, the global radius of curvature of gamma at a point s. This is the inf of r of gamma s, gamma t, gamma, say, tau, over all t and tau different from s. So so for this curve, when you are maybe here, then this rho g would just see the curvature. But when you are here, this rho g would immediately see that there is another. So this is the global radius of curvature, which was introduced, I guess, by Gonzalez and Maddox in 99. And you could take the energy that we called UP of gamma, and it was suggested as a tool for preventing, one of several energies suggested as a tool for preventing self-intersections, which is just the integral over gamma 1 over this rho g to the power p. And the integral is respect to the natural arc length. And then you have, then the scale invariant exponent, as you can all see, is just 1. And as soon as p is bigger than 1, so here we even have the following. If up of gamma is finite for any p, including the scale invariant case, then gamma is a curve of class C1 and simple. And the oscillation of the tangent from S to T is measured by just the, you know, the constant here is 1, by the integral from S to T of 1 over rho g.
It's so, P?
Excuse me?
You raise rho g to the P or?
No.
For all P.
For all P. So I can use a tool which is called Hölder's inequality. And then I can write that this is less or equal, if I have really a p bigger than 1, then I can do this, 1 over p, and here I write s minus t, 1 minus 1 minus p. So this works always, also for p equal to 1. For p bigger than 1, I can do this step, and then somehow the distance of the parameters in the arc length parameterization modulo that power tells me, and modulo a local factor depending on the energy, tells me how close the tangent vectors are. Oh, you could do an intermediate thing between the two. You could take, so here I take two infimizations and one integral. Here I have 0 infimizations and 3 integrals. I could do 1 infimization and 2 integrals. And then the scale invariant exponent would be 2, and I would have a similar result, which I don't want to maybe write down now, because I want to tell you something more. So In fact, there are some properties of knot, properties of knot energies that were named. I guess that most of this terminology is due to Jun Ohara, a Japanese mathematician. And I will write a few names and try to explain you. So the first property is being self-repulsive or charge. What does it mean that a function not defined on knots is self-repulsive on charge? It simply means that if you have a sequence of gamma I, which are simple, but which converge in some topology, let's not worry about that, to a gamma which is not simple. So maybe you have a sequence of loops which converge really to a figure eight with a self-intersection. Then the energy on such a sequence of curves, it should blow up to infinity on any such sequence of curves. There is another property. An energy is tight if it prevents you, if it prevents the knots on a sequence of curves from doing the pull tight phenomenon. What is the pull tight phenomenon? If you have a can I draw a knot? If you have a little knot somewhere here, complicated, yeah, then you could imagine that you have a sequence of loops, and this knot gets smaller, smaller, smaller. What you see in the limit is not a curve with a self-intersection, but just a straight line. It got pulled tight, like a small knot on a thin thread. So the energy is tight if it blows up to infinity in such situations too. Then it is called basic if the only minimum is the round circle. The only absolute minimum among all the curves, say, in our case of fixed length, is the round circle. And it is called unknot distinguishing if, say, the inf of this energy over all curves is strictly smaller than inf of this energy over the knotted curves. And finally, let me use one more entry. It is called strong if there are finitely many knot classes under each energy level. So some energies that people considered have some of those properties, some of them don't have them. I can tell you what we know about this NP. So about MP, for P bigger than 3, we know the following. It is, of course, self-repulsive. But when you have a sequence of loops that goes to a loop with a self-intersection, then it has to blow to infinity.
Okay, but
it also blows to infinity. Because when you take a sequence of loops and you try to fold it so that you have a nearly doubly covered circle, then you have lots and lots and lots of small circles due to two strands being together, and then it blows up to infinity. That's the reason. So it is also strong. And the reason for having only finitely many knot classes under each energy level is basically is this inequality. I will try to tell you where it comes from geometrically in a few minutes, but it somehow tells you that there is, you know, you have a fixed amounts of lengths, only length one, and you have, it tells you that you have controlled bending. You cannot bend too much and too fast. Your bending is controlled by the energy and by the distance in the parameters. So you cannot bend too much, and you can give a bound to the stick number of a knot if you have a bound for the energy, or you can just prove by contradictions that there cannot be infinitely many different knot classes under each energy level. It is also tight. So the pull-tight phenomenon cannot happen. So something like, you know, having a small knot in a ball of smaller and smaller size, this cannot happen because this tells you that at a certain length scale, your curve has to be, roughly speaking, straight. So knots, the same knot in smaller and smaller balls, this cannot happen. The energy would blow up to infinity. And I now can tell you that we absolutely, so we guess that both answers here are yes. But this is something that we are completely unable to prove. So this is open, this is open. What we can prove is, first, we can show that the circle is a critical point of that energy. So you can, that's what Tobias did when he was trying to discretize the gradient flow and writing his algorithm. Then he would first write down the Euler-Lagrange equation for this functional, which is a horrible thing. I've seen his two talks or three talks, and it occupies, if he uses small print, it occupies the whole slide. That's an equation which occupies a whole slide. But he was able to check that if you plug in the parametrization of the circle, then everything cancels out. Zero is equal to zero, so the circle is a critical point. Numerical experiments, when you compute the value,
has to be smooth curves then, if you want to write down Euler equations.
You write it in the sense of distributions, and all you need to know is that they are, say, a little. I will comment on that in more detail later. Okay. So you don't have to assume high smoothness. You can stay below C2. And it turns, in fact, that once your energy is finite, you always have curves that are better than C1. So you're somewhere between C1 and C2, and you don't need C2 in order to write the Euler-Lagrange equation in the sense of distributions. So the numerical experiments would suggest that this is really the minimum. So as soon as you take something planar but different from a circle, the energy grows up. As soon as you start taking non-planar curves, so you take maybe an elongated ellipse and you start bending it so that it becomes, you know, non-planar, then the energy grows radically, really fast. But the real problem in dealing with that is the following thing. So everybody is used to the notion of derivative, and to the notion of an energy which is defined as an integral of derivative of something. And if you take a curve or a function and perturb it locally on a small piece, then the derivative and the classical variation of functionals change only locally. It's a small change. Here, if you perturb your curve locally, it influences the value of this Menger radius R globally. It changes not only at the place where you have changed the curve. If I make a little kink here, like this, then not only the radius will change here, but it will also change here. It will change here. Yeah?
So,
yeah. So somehow this this function that you are integrating detects the global behavior of the curve, and small changes are felt globally. That's the difficulty. So, and we cannot tell you that this is not distinguishing, but again, as soon as you start doing numerics, then you would guess that, yes, of course, it is not distinguishing. And for comparison, if I take here this UP for P bigger than 1, then I have all the answers, yes, 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 from bottom to top. And this is somehow related to the fact that when I take the infimum here, then it tells me a lot more about the behavior of the curve. It's not just averaging, it's a much more precise control of the behavior of the curve. So, and for some, for those intermediate energies, I have no time to speak about all of them. The table looks similar. So we have yes here. So all they are all self-repulsive and tight. They are strong, so they limit the number of knot types under a fixed energy level. In some cases, we can prove that they are un-knot distinguishing. So like you take, just one infimization and two integrals, then you, in this way, you distinguish the un-knot, but we also don't know if it is basic. And of course, when you start writing down the equation of the gradient flow, we have absolutely no proof of existence of solutions. So maybe let me tell you what is the main idea behind the proofs. How do you do it? So the main idea behind is something of the following kind. So suppose that you have, this is meant to be a cylindrical tube, suppose that you have one point of your curve here and another point of your curve here. And then you would like to know, you take a ball around this thing of the same radius, and you would like to know, does the curve in this length scale and which I'm observing it, does it stay in the tube or not? And how is this related to the, you know, thickness of the tube with respect to the radius? Or so mathematicians have names for everything. There is a concept which is called beta number of gamma s at the scale d, so d is this length here, and this is the infimum of the distance of y to the line L scaled by d, and the infimum is taken over all lines through the point gamma of s, and here you take the supremum over y in gamma times this blue ball b, yeah, a ball of radius d. So you look at your curve in that ball. You fix a line first, maybe that one that I have fixed, maybe another one. And you look at your curve in the ball, you look how far can you get from the line. you divide it by d to make it to see if you can get, you know, maybe 1% of the radius of the ball or maybe 10%. And then you choose the line which gives you the best approximation. So naively speaking, it's like looking for the narrowest possible tube with center here containing the curve in the ball. And then you ask yourself, okay, what's the narrowest possible tube? So suppose that I have one point here outside of a tube. Then I would have, since it is a curve, I would have little balls here, here, and here, and little arcs of my curve somehow in those balls. And for any point, for any selection of a triple of points on these arcs, I would have roughly that triangle. It, of course, yeah, so it would wobble a bit, the triangle, but the overall shape would be that one. So the radius wouldn't change much. And it...
So this is like least squares in the moon. So if you had least, instead of squares, you had to the p power, this is the moon.
It is something of that spirit, yes. And when you then try, you know, to see what would be the input to the energy just from that little configuration, it would be too much if you would allow the tube to be too thick. So it turns out that this beta number at any point of your curve at a scale d has to go to zero, like some d to some power. It turns out that it's a different power than this one. But you do this little computation, and then you know that, well, in every scale, those beta numbers have to behave like that. And now what happens when you try to zoom inside and observe what happens here, really? Then maybe your curve, you know, goes like that. So you stop in the middle, you take this point, and you select a smaller tube, which might be tilted, but not too much because you control this width. And then you again stop in the middle and you select another tube, still narrower, which might be tilted, but not too much because you control this. And then you have such an infinite telescope of tilting tubes, and this assumption enters when you try to compute how much they tilt, then this assumption enters. And it tells you that they cannot tilt too much because the sum of the tilt angles gives you a geometric convergence series. And this is not yet, it would be an estimate like that, but with a worse power. And then what you do when you cannot prove it with a good power, then you look for talented young people who can do more than you can. And you tell them that you guess it should be something like that. And the talented young people tell you, okay, there is one more step where you have to iterate more inequalities of that sort, and then you reach that exponent. And in fact, now we have the proof that this is best possible. You cannot obtain anything better. This is best possible control of regularity under this assumption. And in fact, this is something that I don't want to comment on in detail, but to other PhD students of, one former PhD student of Heiko von der Mosel and one former PhD student of mine have shown together that have found an analytic, a hard analytic equivalent condition for this geometric condition. So this energy of a closed loop is finite if and only if the arc length parameterization of that loop is in some horrible fractional Sobolev space. And well, it's a horrible space depending on several exponents, and you don't want to know the definition. It's like having a little bit more than one derivative and not two derivatives. And this a little bit more than one derivative should be integrable with the power p. And this is the best possible embedding that you obtain in the realm of function spaces for that fractional symbol of space. And nothing better is possible. And okay, so maybe one more to close, to finish, because I'm talking for too long now. I want to mention one more result, which we can now prove for several of these energies. And the result is as follows. So suppose that you have two curves, and they all have this Menger energy bounded by some fixed number E. Then there is an epsilon zero depending only on E and P. So here you take P bigger than 3, such that if the Hausdorff distance of those two curves is smaller than epsilon 0, then they are isotopic as nulls. So what does it mean? It means that if I have two curves and I know that they're, you know, close to each other, so every point on one curve is close to some point on the other curve, and vice versa. And you can control this distance by epsilon zero. And you also control the energy. Then both curves represent the same knot. So if you just know that and you know nothing more about the curves, it could happen that one of them stays very close to the other one, but then you have a little knot on one of them tied around the second one. But if you control the energy and you control the distance, then you know that it is small, then you know that it is the same knot. Okay, so maybe that's enough. I won't be able to explain all the technical details, so I would rather stop here and try to answer any questions that any of you might have now.
Thing is usually the step that gives you two things, the existence of minimizers and a good nice step of class, and then for your list, the not distinguishing.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the catch? There's something that's not all there. If it's, you know, if I have, does this give you the existence of a minimizer in each knot?
No, it's independent of the existence of minimizers of the energy in each knot, in each knot class. So to prove the existence of minimizers, you would do the following. So assume that I'm fix a knot class, and I want to minimize my energy in that knot class. I take any sequence of curves, fixed length, one, such that the energy goes down to the infimum. Then for this sequence, I have those inequalities. And this guy here is controlled because the energy goes down to the minimum. So instead of that, I could just write some constant. So these inequalities tell me that the gamma primes are equicontinuous. So I can use a result which is Arcella-Ascoli. Thanks to Rafa for reminding me. And I can select a subsequence which converges in C1 or even C1 alpha. And if a sequence converges in C1, then the isotopy class is preserved. So that's why the limit curve, which is simple, because I know that finite energy excludes surface intersections, then that's why the limit curve stays in the same knot class, because it is isotopic to any of the gamma i's for i for I large, because then the C1 distance between the curves is small. So the picture is even better than this one, because here the curves are close in Hausdorff distance, but maybe the C1 distance between them is pretty large, because the tangents can differ at some points. So we don't need to use that. This is really a very, very strong thing.
So that's even stronger. So doesn't that have the existence of a minimum measure, but we have knots.
We just don't know that it is a circle. I know that it sounds stupid. We know that there is a minimizer. We know that circle is a critical point of the energy, but we don't know.
Well, the problem is here. Okay, I see the problem.
Yeah, we just cannot tell you that the minimizer that exists. So it doesn't tell you anything. This is an existence proof. The thing that we just sketched. It tells you that there is a minimizer. Maybe there are seven of them. And we just would like to know that there is just one, and the circle is the unique one.
Round circle.
Round circle, yeah. Not a topological circle, but really a round circle. And numerics seems to tell us that this is the case, but we simply don't know. We've spent... How much time did we spend on that, Heiko?
We will tell.
If we tell them, they would laugh.
They laugh anyway.
We spent a long time on that.
You'd be happy if you use a convex planar curve.
Each final bit. So there is no control on the curvature, sort of. Probably this question doesn't make any sense, but if you had some sort of way of saying, well, with the sort of usual scalar curvature of a curve, it approaches constant, then you would know that you have a round circle, right? That's too much.
That's a reasonable intuition. It's actually, I would phrase the same thing that you are trying to say in the following way. Suppose that you have just a round circle and you perturb it a little bit. Then you would like to know that the energy grows up. But this little perturbation destroys your R being constant basically everywhere on your curve. And we've been trying to prove that, okay, let us try to prove that the circle minimizes the energy among all convex planar curves, all convex smooth planar curves. I don't know what is the answer. I would bet, you know, a small amount of money that it is a circle, but not too large.
I have a question. You would go like to a physical model, so you would think that this is a kind of in the elastic material like steel, it's now you made out of that something, and then you release this and then see how it will go. The energy, you know, the energy of elastic material, so you can exactly calculate according to elasticity, and so how it would drive such a system. So you make this knot.
That's what you saw. That's what you saw at the beginning
energy is something different. So you put.
But when P is large, it's not here anymore. When P is large, and you approach 1/3 thickness. So it's not so far from elastic energy, and the little movie that was there was for P equal to 50, which is way above this scale invariant case, and it was, you know, just like a closed loop moving and trying to, so the pieces that move fast are the pieces where the curvature is high, because then locally the radius is high. But somehow there is also a repelling between strands that are parallel and almost straight, so they don't bump into each other.
That's the difference to classic elastic energy, because that wouldn't see as a knot. But now we also look at mixtures of knots.
So I mentioned this earlier, right? So if you can imagine, though, that you're asking you immerse this curve in a box of colloids.
Yeah.
Okay. And the colloids want to maximize their entropy, right? And so you forget about the entropy of the curve, and you say, here, the colloids are trying to maximize their entropy. And so what the colloids want is they want the largest amount of room to move around, right? And so if you imagine that this tube has a thickness, right, you want the overlap, you want to minimize the overlap volume, right? And so so that would be a way of trying to do that. But I think the other one, and we discussed it, Meron's not here, but you know, can you imagine a Casimir kind of energy?
What's a Casimir energy?
Casimir's famous, he's a Lanzmann, right? He's great. So what you do is you say, all right, here's this object, it's a tube.
Mm-hmm.
You could say it's a tube of metal, say, right? And so it's a tube where the electric field is always perpendicular to it.
Okay.
Okay. And then you plunge it into an electric field. You plunge it into a medium, and you let the electric field fluctuate quantum mechanically or thermally. All right. And so you see, if you have two plates that are close together, imagine you have two metal plates, then there are fewer modes in here because the field is locked down. Right, and as you bring the plates closer and closer together, there are fewer and fewer modes that go in there. Of course, there's an infinite number, but there's a smaller infinity of them compared to the outside. Right? Right. The outside is the continuum, and now you have a discrete up in the middle. Right? And so you could again say, suppose you had this metal tube, and you plunged it into a field, or you plunged it into something that supported a field. What would minimize the Casimir energy? What shape would do that? I mean, so I think that what Rob said is probably true, right? The challenge to the physicists is to find a physical model that has that as its energy.
I don't know if there's any, but
you didn't mention Juno Harris, the initial example of one, but there you can think of it as something that, again, depends on global.
You mean the Möbius invariant?
Yeah, but there's also a way to think in terms of the field.
Write it down here. Sure. So there is an energy. Which was considered by O'Hara, but also by Friedman, He and Wong. And it is the double integral over gamma. And you take here, so let me write like that, over the parameter space, maybe gamma of s minus gamma of t squared minus 1 over ds t squared ds dt, where you have two points, gamma of s and gamma of t on your curve, then this is dst. This is the length of the shorter arc connecting them on the curve.
So it's the regulated electromagnetic
action. It needs to be regulated for mathematicians, because if you just take this, then the integral diverges.
Yes, that's right.
And this thing regularizes it. So this has some similar features, but for example, something which is not known for this Möbius invariant energy is whether it can be minimized in every knot class. It can be minimized in some knot classes, in the prime knot classes. But as far as I know, it is an open problem if it can be minimized. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be an open problem if it can be minimized in composite knot classes.
And it's also not tight. This is a related.
It is also not tight. Yes, this pull tight phenomenon, a little knot, you know, being pulled tight, with energy remaining bounded, can happen for this energy.
Because you're regularizing it.
Well, because it's scale invariant.
Because it is basically scale invariant, and it's even Möbius invariant. So you can not only scale it up, scale it down, but you can do any Möbius transformation over three. So any inversion with respect to the sphere. So the things which are small after inversion can become large. Things which seem to occupy just 1% of your curve, intuitively after an inversion would occupy 99% of your curve and would not be small at all. So
the problem is you can think of the double integral as inducing a field on the complement of the knot that the rest of the knot, well, the rest of the knot feels. And I guess the, I don't know what the analog for your mu negative curvature is.
I don't know. So here for some of our former PhD students, one of the challenges that they would probably try to attack sooner or later, and they have now lots of tools and lots of analytic insight into those energy, would be the really to prove rigorously the existence of the solutions to the gradient flow of the energy. To be mathematically sure that they do exist, not just, you know, being able to discretize something and to run 750 or 1,000 steps of an algorithm.
So, the stuff that Jay Bannevar has been doing, right, is related in spirit.
Yeah.
Where he says you take a knot and you try to shove it into a sphere of fixed radius. So that puts at least an upper bound on your R.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole thing isn't involved.
So this is one of the. So we've been writing a paper here, which has a slightly larger table in the introduction, and then many answers and some question marks. And one of the answers that one of the positive answers that we can do is the following thing. So suppose that you have an energy that we call Jp of gamma, and it's a double integral, and you take 1 over rxyz to the p, but you take infimum with respect to z, so that it is a function of those variables, and you integrate with respect to those variables on gamma. So this energy, we also don't know if it is basic, so whether the circle is the only minimum, but we can prove that it is basic if you introduce one extra constraint. So if you pack your curve into a ball, and the curve and the ball is chosen in such a way that the great circle on that ball has the length equal to that curve. So you try to maybe you could think of it like that. You take a ball, you take a great circle, and you try to squeeze it in any way inside the ball. And then you measure this energy. So if you would take this great circle from a ball and squeeze it inside, then this energy would grow. This is something that we can prove rigorously, no matter how you deform the curve. But we cannot prove this without this constraint. Again, we would.
Maybe can you remember who's the guy, the mathematician who worked with Tom
Tom
Witten. You guys are just gonna stare at
me.
Tom Witten is at the University of Chicago. No, he's at the University of Chicago. Where they talked about taking instead of curves, they took sheets, right? And they shoved sheets into balls.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing arbitrary dimensions, right? And they were. Right, it was arbitrary dimensional sheets and arbitrary dimensional balls. Do you know this work?
We don't know this work, but we also do higher dimensional stuff that I did not mention here. Right. We do energies for submanifolds in any dimension and codimension.
I mean, there was something, you know, the interesting thing there was shoving the sheet in without deforming it isometrically. And so, it was interesting, there are dimension rules, right, of what you can shove in, because whether you have enough, you have a hypersurface with some codimension, you need enough codimension to be able to bend it without stretching it. So that's what they were interested in. But then they did all this, they did lots of numerical work. There's a Reviews of Modern Physics article by Tomlin about this, about crumpling sheets.
Witten.
Yeah, Tomlin.
Like Ed Witten, but no, Tomlin.
Tomlin.
No, Tomlin. Yeah, but the Witten like in Ed Witten.
There's a lot of work of packing of DNA in viruses, so they pack this.
That's right.
Linear.
Also that, right?
And that's, I think there's substantial work on this packing.
Yeah, so maybe we have to look up at Tom Witten.
Okay.
I also have a question. Did we try applying this energy to links?
What do you mean applying it to links?
Well, you compare two circles embedded in R3.
It would be the same.
But do all the conclusions hold back?
Can you minimize in it a link class?
Yeah.
Sure. Just think about a link with two components. Okay? And if you have an energy bound, it tells you that the piece of curve on each component has to be approximately straight in a length scale dictated by the energy. So it cannot, the phenomenon of the following kind, so that one component of the link starts eating up the whole length, total length of the link, and the other component of the link goes, its length goes down to zero. This cannot happen. They all need to retain a certain amount of length. And then you do this Arcella-Ascoli argument that we mentioned in each component separately. And you know that the total image has to be a one-dimensional manifold, possibly disconnected, but that's fine. It's just a union of two circles. And when you go down, then one component converges to something and the other component converges to something. That's it. You can minimize it in every link class.
So your R has 2 points on one curve and 1 point on the other curve?
It has 3 points arbitrarily chosen on any of the components. Yeah, all the possible triples of points that sit 1 point here, 1 point here, 1 point here, and your gamma could be a union of two curves.
The guy's name is Shankar Venkata.
Do you see if I had maybe that, yeah?
Venkata Ramani, he's in Arizona now, he was in Chicago.
Then I would consider that triple, but also that triple, and also that triple.
Thanks.
And also this triple. All the possible triples, I don't care where the points are. They are in my object. And this object is the union of two or five curves or whatever. So this would be the same. The pull tight phenomenon couldn't happen. The link couldn't bump into itself. So one loop couldn't bump into the other one, and any one of the loop couldn't bump into itself. But of course, I cannot tell you what would happen here.
What about different functions of R?
Here you only have powers, but you can have sort of
singularity at zero,
So I guess. So what you can do? That's ugly stuff. You could add a logarithmic correction, yeah, or something like that. It wouldn't be much different. I would guess that that what is really important is the scale invariant case. And amazingly, in the scale invariant case, we know that this part of the result remains true. So in the scale invariant case P equal to 3, the image of the segment has to be topologically a circle or a segment, but we cannot tell you if it has it cannot have corners like that or not. But we cannot exclude the following behavior. Imagine that you have a three-dimensional spiral going like that, yeah, in a cone, And it's not a logarithmic spiral or a geometric spiral. So the spiraling happens in a very small scale at each step. So when you look at this from a distance, you basically see a C1 piece, and there is some tiny little spot here, and you don't see what happens there. Then you go inside. It was maybe 99% of your curve was basically straight. You go inside into this little spot, this 1%, and then you see, okay, 99.9% of it is nearly straight, but there is some slight twisting. And then you zoom down and you see that there is spiraling occurring, but you know, there are longer and longer stretches that look like a C1 curve, but eventually there is infinitely many spiraling, and we cannot exclude that. That's one of my little nightmares connected to those. I hope that this cannot happen, but I cannot exclude that. We don't know that it is C1. We don't even know that it is differentiable everywhere. There could be points where you have no tangent vector.
But if you assume it's tame, you're done, right?
It could be, Randy, it could be unknotted.
But it could be tame. If it's tame, then you're done, right?
It's tame. It could be tame. It could be unknotted.
Isotopic to a polygon?
Yeah.
It is. It's a graph over.
It could be a graph over the line.
Oh, I see.
It could be a graph over the line. So it could be a graph of a function which goes from the line to R2.
Right.
And even then, I don't know if I take p equal to 3, then if the finiteness of this energy tells me that it is differentiable everywhere. I don't know this.
You get any kind of, so you don't know that you get that those T and S approach each other, those approach each other if they're defined. Do you get any kind of continuity? If I just formally took p equals 3 there, then I imagine I'm getting, you know, some kind of a constant.
Sure,
no.
The constant divergence.
What happens to CP as P goes?
No. So.
I
can start using jargon now. I can tell you what I would be willing to guess or to conjecture. I would be willing to guess that the tangent vector has vanishing mean oscillation, but not more. And those two guys that I mentioned, Blatt and Kolaschinsky, they have a result which tells you if you take a C1 curve, if you take a curve which is a priori C1, and you assume that the Menger energy with p equal 3 is finite, then they tell you for a C1 curve, M3 being finite is equivalent to this curve being in some ugly function space that we don't know, that we don't want to know about here. But this ugly function space tells you that the tangent has vanishing mean oscillation. So it's a critical case, and the information you get from the embeddings of function spaces is weaker, somewhat weaker than what you initially have to assume in order to be able to work. It doesn't, in the supercritical case, you get stronger information. Does anyone else have any sort of comment, question?
Thank you again.
Thank you for your patience.